the behavior of the 14-year-old.
About Jesus
and Mary. Mary was a teenager.
Well, the whole concept there is virgin birth. So the concept is that no hanky-panky was going on. That's the whole idea behind the basis of a big part of the religion. Maybe you missed that part.
It's okay for older guys to...
Well, the thing is, in the 70s, it kind of was. In fact,
just illegal.
Yeah, well, yeah. Even at the time, it was illegal to do what she says he did. That's pretty clear. But it probably never happened in Hollywood either, you know?
No, exactly.
See, Richard Dreyfuss is being accused now. 1982 thing.
Once more under the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and...
Jake.
McClure. Where you will hear Jake say...
Yes.
Oh, well, at this point we do disclosures, and the disclosure, which is despite the name of the term disclosure... has nothing to do with taking one's clothes off, but it does have to do with being transparent, which I guess is sort of a ghostly sort of thing. First disclosure is, this is Jeff talking. Jeff is a veteran, and today is Veterans Day. Therefore, he may be prejudiced about something. I'm not sure what, so there's a conflict of interest in that area. Second thing is that the Personal Wealth Coach is an investment advisory firm. And as an investment advisory firm, it's registered with the United States Securities and Exchange Commission, which doesn't imply that they approve or disapprove of what we're doing, but it does mean that that's who we are. And we're based in Salado, Texas, and our firm has the same name as the radio program. And let's see, what else have I got to tell you? What we give on the air here today is information that we've gotten from sources we generally consider reliable. Things like the Wall Street Journal and Financial Times and The Economist and such as that. But is it guaranteed? And what we talk about on the radio program today or any other day is not investment advice, even though we are, our firm is a registered investment advisor and we are principals in that firm. Investment advice is something we give to individuals based on individual circumstances, and it's inappropriate to give investment advice to the masses of people because what's good for you may be disastrous for somebody else and vice versa. So, is there anything else I need to do? Close cover before strike?
Yeah,
that doesn't count because we don't... when's the last time you saw a matchbook that actually said that?
Close cover before striking? I don't know that I've ever seen that.
I've seen it, you know, but I'm old.
I don't know that I've ever seen it. I know I've heard it a lot, close cover before striking,
I think we need to go to...
I have seen hot coffee may be hot.
Yeah, coffee may be hot. Well, this coffee is hot at McDonald's. It says. I think maybe a better example of a proper caveat, warning, disclosure is objects in mirror may be closer than they appear.
That is pretty good.
Because people can see that. I mean, these look up to your right mirror, and there'll be a little thing down at the bottom that you don't pay any attention to.
Yeah.
And if you watch the T-Rex or with his head stuck around the corner.
Right. Jurassic Park. You're dating yourself again.
I'm dating myself?
Yeah. Yeah. It's a very romantic thing, I know. But by saying that, you know, Jurassic Park.
Well, that's one of the newer movies.
Quite a long time ago now. The newest version of it came out, 2 years ago?
Did it have... The objects in mirror may be closer than they appear?
I don't think so. This is the one from way back. When you know those two little kids in that movie?
Yeah.
They are full-grown adults and into almost their 30s.
Mm-hmm. No, they can't be.
It's incredible, and now we all feel old.
Well, I think the science fiction movie, I read a great science fiction book 1984 about the distant future, and then I read, and then I watched a movie that really impressed me about how things were going to be. Actually, two movies. One, 2001, A Space Odyssey, about how we would be, we'd have a colony on the moon. And
yeah, yeah.
And the other one was Back to the Future. And at this point, of course, we have, and it's for basically
we're beyond the point that the future was back then.
Yeah, where we have flying cars and hoverboards that really do hover.
Welcome to the future's past, or the past's future. Yes.
Anyway, phone call coming in. And the telephone number to call in here if you would like to join us, presuming that today is Veterans Day where you are too, is 254-773-1400. And we have a caller on the number. Welcome to the Personal Wealth Coach. You are on the air.
That's so good questions. And let me throw in, because this is a segue to something I said I was going to talk about.
But I want to comment on that.
Okay, you go ahead and comment on it, and I'll come in and comment after.
You'll come in and segue. Economic sanctions, if we assume that whoever is in charge of the country has any degree of rationality about themselves, or is in other than a personal survival mode, economic sanctions are very effective. But it's really good to remember the way they're perceived from the other side. Now, the two things there. One, if you've got a dictator in charge who realizes that if he relaxes power the least little bit,
he's out of power.
The mass, not only is he out of power, he's probably dead.
Probably not in a pleasant way either. Slowly snooze yourself into the dreamless slumber of death.
It's probably get beat to death or burned up or hung on or
ripped apart. Yeah, some kind of nasty way that dictators usually die.
So it doesn't have a lot of effect if you say, I'm going to starve your people and hurt your economy. And if you respond positively and change your behavior, you will be ripped into small pieces by the same people.
Right.
And, whoever the dictator is, he might consider it for a moment. But then he'd probably just go on and do his business. Now, and the other thing is really important to remember that economic blockades and sanctions are considered by most of the world to be an act of war, and thereby justify the tanks and bullets and ships and airplanes.
Right. I don't think it's the tariffs and blockades are ever going to replace bullets or tanks or whatever replaces bullets and tanks, lasers and railguns.
Violence.
Violence. It's not going to replace violence. It's one step on the road to either preventing or causing violence. If you will recall history just a little bit, the Pearl Harbor attack. The Japanese did not believe that they were instigating a war when they did it. They thought that the tariffs that we applied to them were the instigations to war. Mm-hmm. Now, we look at trade differently. We don't look at it in the United States as a war-type footing. But what was our response to Russia invading Ukraine? Was sanctions. It is an act that is up to the line of we're not using force yet.
And we, for whatever it's worth, I don't know, 60 years or so, we've had an economic sanctions and a blockade.
Against North Korea
and
Cuba?
No, against Cuba and North Korea. And it hasn't produced a lot of change that we would consider positive.
Right. It when it works well. But it doesn't work very often.
Or well.
When it does work, it works well. So it worked in Libya.
Yeah, Muammar Gaddafi determined that our sanctions should cause him to let up on the pressure on his own people a little bit, and he saw what happened to him.
Yes, he got replaced. So it worked from our perspective. From the perspective of the person with the sanctions on it, it doesn't work at all. They gave up nuclear weapons. They paid us a bunch of money, and Scotland a bunch of money, for terroristic acts in the past, and then promptly were replaced by people that we supported.
And very frankly, you know, we had massive economic sanctions against Syria, and it's not done. I mean, this is one of the bad sides of this that I don't know that we think about very much. But sometimes our economic sanctions levied against a country produce a worse outcome than if we had done nothing.
Right. That it's a tool that's used appropriately. If you have an alliance with someone and you're on good terms with them and they do something that upsets you and you do a direct, equal, measured response, it can lead to some kind of settlement. But anybody that's been in a long-term romantic or otherwise relationship knows that if one of you slights the other and you reciprocate in kind, as a conscious effort, you hurt me, therefore I will hurt you, that rarely leads to peace. That rarely leads to peaceful living together.
And it doesn't work particularly well with teenagers either.
Right. So the idea is that if someone does something intentionally to hurt someone else, and you believe by reminding them with some intense punishment for a short period of time that they shouldn't do that anymore, and those specific character traits, if there's a country that's not a major player on the scene, that wants to be trading with the rest of the world, and they make a mistake somewhere, they know it's a mistake, we punish them a little bit, it tends to have some results. But it's not just the Japanese that were taunted into war by embargoes. The Germans were in the same boat, although they were in a landlocked boat at the time. World War II was predicated on the idea that Germany had been smacked with so many sanctions after World War I to pay for the damages for the rest of the world that they were in a state of poverty. And their reaction over decades later was to attack people.
It's one of the things I think living in Germany and talking to the people who went through this that we don't get is following World War I, and by the way, the United States did not participate in these sanctions. The Allies, Britain and France specifically, levied really horrific economic sanctions against Germany. And as a result, the German common person, almost every one of them, knew somebody who had died as a result of those sanctions. I mean, they literally had either starved or frozen to death because Germany was under such tremendously oppressive economic sanctions, and that's how Hitler wound up in power.
Right. Sanctions tend to turn a country nationalistic. It tends to make them follow a strong leader who's willing to fight the rest of the world to defend their nation. We've done it in our history, and I'm not going to give examples of that. That's homework for you guys. There's lots of times where we've been threatened, and our response has been to build higher walls and to keep other people out. We've also had situations where that's a good thing to do, but it's rarely as an emotional response. We got another call coming in, and there's some more stuff to talk about on this subject. So
caller, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead. I think I know what you're talking about, and I think I can give you an answer.
Right.
Ideally, when we have an emergency or a war, historically, we have raised taxes across the country
Or issued specific bonds to pay for that emergency.
Yeah, but,
like the World War II, we issued bonds and
we raised taxes. And we treat that specially, and we treat it as a debt that needs to be recognized and paid off. Now, when the hurricanes hit recently, or in the Iraqi and Afghan wars, we didn't raise taxes. We simply borrowed more money. And there's a great irony here in that the same people who have indicated a willingness to shut down the government over excess debt have also sworn no new taxes. But when an emergency comes up or an issue comes up where they think we need to spend money, they will vote to spend the money, but they won't vote to raise the taxes to pay for the event. So what we have, we're kind of like a dysfunctional family. And one of the partners has the control of the checkbook and the credit card, and the other one says, we really need to spend money on this, give money to this or spend money on that or hire attorneys to do this. And the other one says, that's okay, I'll just borrow some money on my credit card. And that'll work for a while. And frankly, as long as our economy is growing and your pay, in the case of the family, the pay is going up, as long as the debt's not rising faster than the pay, then it's probably okay. It's not a bad thing at all. But one of the things, and Jake and I will probably talk about this today, that we are looking at this new tax bill in Congress right now and saying, well, wait a minute. You're just going to increase the debt by only $1.5 trillion, and that's okay, and there's no plan to raise money to pay that back at any point?
That means where is the money going to come from? At some point, the bankers stop loaning or the people stop loaning, and that's a danger.
Where does the money come from? It comes from the fact that a lot of people want to loan us money because we have a very, very stable economy and a very, very stable currency. Matter of fact, our currency is far more stable than gold or any place else they could put the money, and far more secure, considered to be far more secure around the world. And as a result, they'd just be thrilled to loan us more money at low interest rates. The problem is that the reason we're so secure is we can pay our debts. But I can tell you that one of the immutable facts of finance is if you keep borrowing a lot more than you're earning,
at some point,
eventually you'll get to where you can't pay your debts.
Right. And I'm going to flip back because this is good point to transition back over to Venezuela, which the first caller called on.
Where they can't pay their debts.
Right. This week, this sounds like I'm going to come with a completely different set of information here. So just bear with me. It's going to connect. This week on Friday, the price of gold dropped, but specifically the drop took place in about 5 minutes. The gold market dropped about 1% in 5 minutes. Wasn't hugely covered because it was so fast and recovered a little bit.
Jake would not tell me what this is, so I'm waited with baiting breath because he knows why the price of gold. Is that where all the money came from in our office?
Yeah, we sold a lot of gold. That's right. No. This coming week on Wednesday, in the morning on Wednesday, Venezuela owes $300 million.
Ah!
Aha! Yeah, you're connecting it.
The little line appeared between the dots.
In the last year, Venezuela has shipped two large shipments of gold. About $13 billion of gold at the old prices and much lower than that now to Switzerland so that they could quickly trade it for cash so that they could pay their debts. They have about $2 billion worth of it left. They have been selling that gold over the last 2 years as fast as they can to pay the debts that they can so that they can continue to borrow money. There's a debt payment coming due on Wednesday. It's due in the morning on Wednesday, which means that the gold needed to be sold. They didn't sell it the way a smart investor sells a large amount of something. They dumped it. So $300 million of gold being sold in one purchase payment even if it was one seller. So they listed it for sale, and then it was snapped up at a low price quickly. It was a 1% drop. They got whatever it was, that I think probably the $300 million or so. There was a volume change during that time period that looks like it. Now, I can't, there's no way to prove that that's exactly what happened. All we can do is look at the circumstances. So that's circumstantial evidence. They have a debt payment due. We know they're going to sell gold to do it. About the right amount of gold was sold all at once. And the debt payment, almost immediately after that, the Venezuelans said, we're going to make our debt payment, which they had been saying maybe we'll make it before. So suddenly something changed. It had to do with gold. They were already shipping gold. All of the pieces line up. We can say Venezuela is selling gold. And this is another reason why we warn people about the myth that gold is something that's stability in a crisis. Because a lot of big investors, countries, have purchased gold for the mythical stability in a crisis. So if there's a crisis that's big enough to hit multiple large owners of gold at the same time, they need to convert that gold to cash in order to use it. So they sell it at the same time in the middle of the crisis. It's something that's happened throughout history. Even, I mean, Pompeii, it was written about in Pompeii. Pliny the Elder survived. His son died. Oh, no, it was his Pliny the Younger that lived. His Pliny the Elder died.
Actually, both of them eventually died.
Eventually, they both died.
Yes.
But both of them were historians and documentarians of the time. They were generals in the Roman legions and admirals, and they were the ones that led the evacuation of Herculaneum and Pompeii. And the prices of jewels and gold for the next two decades were at a extreme low point because Pompeii was a very wealthy in jewel and gold location in the empire. It was a vacation spot, and the people that left took only that. That's all they had. They needed to buy new property, new places to live, so they all were dumping gold and jewels on the market. That's what happens in catastrophes to the price of gold, silver, jewels.
And it doesn't even take a catastrophe.
No.
Because one of the great economic forces that everybody outside of economics professors and a few, most economists are unaware of this. One of the great forces that shaped Europe and ultimately, by the way, resulted in the United States existing was the Spanish discovery of lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of gold in the Mayan and Inca temples and them shipping it back to Spain, where Spain suddenly became phenomenally wealthy with lots and lots and lots of gold. And they started spending it like it was water. And pretty soon,
the price of gold dropped quite a lot.
Tulip bulbs worth more than gold.
If you get enough gold, that's the definition of inflation. There's more gold than the value created that it's buying.
The price of gold dropped by, let's put it like this, in about 2 years they had 1,000% inflation. And everybody's money was based on gold. That caused a massive depression
throughout Europe.
All across the civilized world, for that matter. It even affected China, which is pretty amazing considering how long it took to get to China.
Now, pieces of eight were used during that time period throughout the world because the gold was pure, but it also, because there were enough to be used throughout the world, it was kind of the first man-made global currency. Yeah. Cowrie shells were a global currency before that, but they weren't man-made.
And those of you who are old guys like me can remember something from the past, and that is gold. When we had the gold standard prior to 1971, gold was set, the price of gold was set by the United States government, it was actually the Bretton Woods group of nations, at $35 an ounce. And
that's where the stability myth comes
from. Silver was set at $1 per ounce, and a silver dollar was worth $1. And that the reason they put the prices there is following World War II. That World War II, but
the Second Bretton Woods.
That was an appropriate price for gold and silver. But in order to keep speculation from occurring and the prices from fluctuating, the nations, the civilized nations of the world, as they were called at the time, the United Nations, they were called, the Allies, all agreed that it would be illegal for their citizens to actually own gold or silver bullion. They could own it in the form of jewelry.
Or candlesticks.
Or ornaments. But there was no way to sell it, for its gold value. It was illegal to sell it for the value of the gold internal.
The only reason why it maintained its value is because there was a massive market manipulation by the governments of the world to say gold and silver is worth this amount. Nobody mess with it.
And actually, gold had risen to about, I think, $140 an ounce on the open market outside of the civilized countries by the time the 1971 and the gold standard.
Yeah, it's kind of like the price of copper in 2007 or so. Price of copper went way, way up, and people were just melting down pennies, and they were making 3 or 4 cents worth of money off of 1 penny's worth of copper, and then the mint said, okay, we're going to put a zinc core in the middle. Stop doing that. So, I mean, that's anytime you use a commodity as a currency, whether that's Bitcoin, gold, copper, silver, doesn't matter, you are completely at the mercy of the supply of that commodity.
And I want to correct myself. In 1971, when the gold standard collapsed, the United States and other nations, except France, were insisting that the price of gold was $35, when on the free market outside of the mainstream countries, it was selling for $44.60, which, $9 differential. But $9...
It's a big deal.
...was almost a third.
It's part of the reason.
50% gain, if you could. And so the French came along and said, hey,
let's do a swap.
We got a bunch of paper money here, and we're on the gold standard.
It's backed by gold.
We've been accumulating all this paper money, and besides that, and this was de Gaulle, by the way, he said, you have insulted us so badly by not telling us where the invasion was and telling us the invasion was going to be in Calais that I'm going to get even with you.
D-Day. Yeah. The government in exile was so full of German spies that you whispered to them, and moments later Hitler knew about it.
Yeah, and so de Gaulle got even by demanding gold in exchange for all the dollars he'd been accumulating.
This is 25, 30 years later that he does this demand, mm-hmm. but it's what destroyed the gold standard across the world, is that they said, you give us this gold and we're going to go turn around and sell it for $44 an ounce instead of the $35 an ounce that we can get it for here. And Nixon said, no, we're going off the gold standard.
And then we got some really good inflation because nobody had a clue how to handle it.
Right, because we had been based on an artificial mark for so long. Nobody knew how to handle inflation anymore, and thus we had Carter's double digits. Now, let's head back to one more piece of the question that the first caller asked.
Okay.
Venezuela.
Actually, it's Venezuela.
Venezuela.
You got to leave the zoo in there.
You keep saying that, but you say it more improperly than anybody I've ever heard.
I do?
Oh, yes. We say Venezuela completely improperly. I'm positive of it. Yes, just like we say Germany completely improperly. It's spelled G-E-R-M-A-N-Y, and it's pronounced Deutschland. So our English pronunciation of foreign countries is horrible because we just make up our own versions of it. So I'm convinced that we both say it wrong in some way, and the more we try to make our accent Venezuelan or however they would pronounce it, the more hilarious it becomes. But they have a debt restructuring committee. I'm going to address that with the sanctions and all that good stuff. We got another caller coming in. Caller on 773-1400, you're on the air. Go ahead. On the air.
You scared him off.
Scared him by saying he's going to talk about this.
Venezuela is the way we should pronounce it.
We should just say that country down there. Sitco. Venezuela has a lot of debt.
Yes, and did you know that?
Sounds like the beginning of a nursery rhyme.
A number of their creditors have already filed for insurance coverage.
Yes. Yeah, and we now really do have a caller on 773-1400, so we'll get this and then we'll hit Venezuela.
You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Well, we appreciate you.
Yeah, you're appreciated now. That's, yeah. You can.
Absolutely.
You, let me point something out here. You guys mixed up with somebody else. We've never told you to follow somebody's portfolio and you
can do
that model portfolio. Okay.
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 I think we've got four questions there because the you did a third one twice. So we'll answer the second third one as well as the others.
The first third one.
Yes.
3A and 3B.
I'm glad you're having a good Veterans Day.
Yeah. And he said he's going to hang out.
Yes.
So I guess he's going to. Yeah. Well, you can go straight to a fund.
Or straight to, yeah, that's.
And I would, but the issue is, you say you're poor.
Well, let's go in order. Let's kind of go in order. Because okay. He said, if you go to an advisor, first he said, what's high net worth?
Yeah, and that's a very good question. It depends on who you are. What would you say was high net worth?
High net worth.
A million?
Generally around a million is kind of a standard thing. Although I don't know that there's anybody that's gone out and said what the exact number is. When you've got an amount of owned things that have gotten complicated enough that you need help figuring out what to do with it, even if you spend a lot of time working on it yourself, but you have another job, then I would consider that high net worth. There are people that have tens of millions of dollars that may not consider themselves high net worth, and there's people with 500,000 that may consider themselves high net worth. When you hear an advertisement saying that they help people with high net worth, it's likely that they're saying, they're talking about complexity rather than money. They're saying you need help because you've gotten to the point where you are by putting money away and investments away, and now you have them in 20 different places and you need some help putting them all back together again.
I went to the Oracle at Wikipedia.
Okay.
And the Oracle at Wikipedia said that the financial services industry generally considers a net worth of $1 million or higher to be high net worth.
Right.
And that's a regulatory issue, I think.
Right. Well, it is because the word sophisticated investor generally
right.
means that you have $1 million, which I think is absurd because sophistication should not be based on if somebody wins the lottery, they don't suddenly become sophisticated.
Then there's the ultra high net worth, which is $30 million in liquid financial assets, according to Merrill Lynch World Report, and or with a disposable income of more than $20 million. Disposable?
Well, I don't know. If you have a disposable income, I don't know anybody that likes to dispose of their income. Do you?
I know some people who've done a very good job of it.
I know people that consume their income, but I hope they're not just disposing of it.
Well, they dispose of it at the stores and on Amazon. Well,
hopefully they're consuming that. I mean,
yeah, but they don't really. How do you consume a car? I've tried eating them. They don't taste good.
Just ask Consumer Reports. So they're the ones that talk about cars and consuming. So they should have some kind of car diet that we can go on.
Yeah. Anyway, so high net worth, probably a million or more.
Yeah.
Some people below, and when you say net worth, a lot of people don't think about their net worth. They talk about income. They say a millionaire means the person has $1 million in income. But oddly enough, some people with $1 million in income don't have $1 million in net worth. So it's pretty complicated. People who have a lot of money.
And not a lot of debt.
And not a lot of debt, by whatever definition, are high net worth. Now, what was the second one?
The next one was that if you go to a financial advisor or investment advisor, and the difference is important there. We've gone into it a lot in the past, and we may again in the future, but one's a fiduciary and one isn't. But they charge a fee, and say they invest you in mutual funds. Well, mutual funds also charge fees.
Yes.
Even if they are unmanaged, if they are just like an index fund, they're going to have an internal fee in there for doing the buying and the selling of this of the individual investments inside the mutual fund.
Well, here's the answer, I think, to that question about if everybody's charging me a fee, why don't I just do it myself?
You can.
You can. And you can also do the electricity in your house yourself. You can also do the plumbing in your house yourself. And I've done both.
And you can, and I've done that as well. I've rewired and replumbed houses. And
what I've discovered that usually when I plumb something for the first time, I wind up down the road needing to hire a plumber and paying more than I would have paid to begin with to fix the thing that I screwed up.
I love the word plumber, by the way, just as a
stupid,
useless trivia. That's Latin for lead because they used to make the pipes out of lead. We don't do that anymore, but we still call the people who fix our pipes leaders. People who
plumbers.
Yes. So the plumb line,
in Latin.
Plumb line, when you drop a straight line down with a weight on the end, it's because there's a lead weight on the end, so you get a straight line. Plumb out, I have no idea what that comes from.
Yeah, well,
we're plumb out of answers on that one.
Well, that's because we dropped it like a lid.
Maybe
put down like a lid balloon.
Yeah, maybe the pipe no longer has water in it.
But the point is that if you buy a mutual fund, obviously, but let's say you buy a mutual fund. The purpose in buying a mutual fund is you get, let's say you're interested in stocks, you get a whole bunch of stocks. Like if, let's say you bought an S&P 500 index fund that really emulated the S&P 500, there's not very many, you get 500 stocks and you can't afford to buy 500 stocks. You buy an individual stock from a discount broker, yeah, you get a pretty good deal, but what if the company declares bankruptcy the next day?
The diversification concept, if you buy go to a discount brokerage firm, and there's a lot of them out there, some of them charge... Some of them give you the first 30 trades for free. There are lots of different trading firms out there. You can buy an individual stock. But if you do, no matter how good that stock is, there are risks to that stock. And the risks are things you cannot control. If you are okay with those risks and you understand them, then you can save some management fees by doing that.
And people thought, for example, as they do again today, by the way, that General Motors, for example, was so secure they could just buy it and forget about it.
But
remember, General Motors declared bankruptcy.
Union Carbide.
That means if you own the stock, you lost your money.
And it doesn't take even a risk that we can see. Any tech company, and tech is a kind of ambivalent term, any kind of new technology, whether it's Google or Apple or Facebook or Snap, any one of those companies in 5 years could be non-existent or could be twice as valuable. And that's part of the risk that you take by individual investing. If you spread your money out over a lot of investments, you've diversified. Well, how much diversification do you need? It depends on you. So hopefully when you go to a financial advisor, there's two things that are being provided. One, which funds to go into, and two, why. Now, this is that second part is rarely understood, and that's something that I think this is something I tell everybody that I talk to in a professional way. It's, I wouldn't go far as to call it investment advice because it's not specific to what investment. It's more a philosophy. You should always know why you're buying an investment before you buy it. That seems like a no-brainer. When by why, I mean, you know what it is that you're buying. When people say, should I buy Bitcoin? The first question I ask is, do you know what Bitcoin is? If they say no, I say no. If you don't know why you're buying it, if it's just because other people have bought up and it went up, then you don't know why it will go down. So secondly, before you invest, you should know why you're going to sell it. Before you buy it.
And when you'll sell it.
And
what will trigger the sale?
What will trigger, what is the reason why you would sell it? So people that come to me and they say, for instance, I want to buy Bitcoin or I want to buy XYZ stock. My answer to them is why? If they say because it's been going up, I say that's not a good reason. You need to know why it's going up. If you know why it's going up, then you can understand that.
Well, I said, I listened to you, and it's going up because there's more buyers than sellers.
Right. Typically, someone that buys something because it's going up has a good reason for selling, and that's because it's going down.
And
if you sell things low and buy things high, and that's the opposite of what you want to be doing. Mm-hmm. So having a good reason why you buy it and why you sell it before you buy it. Okay, and hopefully that's provided by someone that you pay if you're going to some kind of advisor. That's part of why you pay them. A mutual fund has a prospectus, and in the prospectus they say, this is what we're doing. This is our goals. This is why we're doing what we're doing.
And I would say that if you buy a mutual fund, you'll notice on the application it says read the prospectus carefully. Read and understand the prospectus carefully prior to investing. And down at the bottom it says, I have read and understood the prospectus. And if you're lying, you probably ought not to buy the mutual fund.
Right. Understanding why the mutual fund is doing what it's doing and why. I mean, why is it doing that? It generally will have a goal. If the goal of if that mutual fund doesn't fit into your goals, then you've got the wrong ones. And there are a lot of mutual funds. That's why people pay advisors, because they look at it and they say, I don't have time to do it even for the 10 funds in my 401k. I don't have time to read through this stuff. I need somebody to tell me what it is.
And the same is true on individual stocks. If you cannot read and understand the annual report, and you don't read and understand the annual report of a company, and you want to buy their stock, you're not investing.
You're gambling.
You're owning something that you don't know what is or how it makes its money. And if you can't explain those clearly, then you've got a problem. Now,
let me take a step back and give an analogy that people understand right away. Because if you're not a small business owner, you at least know someone who is. If you were going to buy a small business,
or buy even a piece of it.
Or even, a small percentage ownership or a large percentage ownership. And the person who owns it says to you, we've been doing great. People are buying our business for more than they've ever bought it for before. Well, how are your profits? What are the books look like? How is it that you are making a living? What is the excess of money that you're making? What's the reason for it? What are you selling? Those are all important questions, and nobody in their right minds would buy a small business without knowing that stuff.
And even to parallel that, if you think about buying a rental property,
right?
The first thing you want to do is see the books and see the appraisal.
How often is it full? What is the rent that you can charge?
What's the cash flow? Is there any free cash flow, or is it all going back in to pay
repairs and expenses
and mortgage and things like that, so that you will have to pull out of your pocket?
Unfortunately, a lot of people buy rental properties without looking into that first, but that's why you would pay a professional in any investment world.
We have 10 minutes left in the hour,
and we've got some commercials to play. And then we got to talk some more about Venezuela's debt restructuring effort.
Yeah, that's going to be fun. We'll eventually get around that, and we might even get to talking about the tax bill at some point.
Oh, yeah. Which one?
Or the proposal.
Which one? Anyway, we'll be back on the other side. We've got some more commercials to play. If you'd like to call us, our phone number in here is 254-773-1400.
And this is the Personal Wealth Coach.
We'll be back.
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. On this November 11th, 2017, Veterans Day, and all of my fellow veterans, I will just simply say, hey.
Good job, guys.
No matter what you did or didn't do, as the case may be.
Thanks,
and, you know, I'm glad you did it, because following World War II, we developed a strategy in the United States, and we've maintained that strategy ever since. We don't want any more wars fought on American soil or even American territorial soil, so we will take our wars to wherever we perceive a threat. And sometimes that has worked really, really well, and sometimes it's worked really, really poorly. And it's always been expensive for the people who did it.
Well, I would even say in the really, really poorly situations, it still didn't result in a war on American soil.
Well, it came pretty close during Vietnam.
Yeah, well, it came pretty close during the Cuba Missile Crisis in Vietnam.
But I'm talking about the war we came close to having a civil war. We had violence in the streets.
Yeah.
For example, we may look, and a lot of people do, at Iraq, Afghanistan, and in Syria, and the wars that we have fought there and are fighting there as a waste of time and money, because, I mean, Steve Bannon, among other things, said we should just pull completely out of Afghanistan and forget about it.
Right.
But this is the point.
We were there for a reason.
We were there to cripple Islamic terrorist organizations that had just attacked the United States. And if you'll notice, there's been no major coordinated attack since then.
Yeah, we've had attacks.
But they've been minor lone wolf attacks.
Yeah, and even the really bad ones are minor percentage values of 9/11. Mm-hmm. We're trying to prevent the big ones.
If we keep disrupting the organizational security of the people who want to do us harm, and that takes human beings with boots on the ground and
bullets in the guns
and bullets in the guns and fighter pilots who are willing to go in and do the job, and Navy people who are willing to go far, far away. And we don't think about the risk of being in the Navy, but anytime somebody sails up off the coast of Iran, I think they recognize that Iran has anti-ship missiles and
they shoot them occasionally just for the fun of it. Going by Yemen, the United States has destroyed, I think we're at six now, six anti-ship emplacements that have fired on United States vessels.
Mm-hmm. So whatever service a person is in, they're either supporting, they're undergoing some difficulties, hardships, and relatively low pay for the purpose of preventing war from coming to us. And we sometimes tend to forget that. And this is, and
thank you guys.
We certainly forget why today is today. Today is November 11th, 11/11. It's a very, very special day because it's Armistice Day. It was the end of World War I. And the people who went off to fight World War I had these wonderful ideals about go and assist the French and get the war over with in a hurry and then we'd be done. And they went through something that was as horrific, or maybe even more so, than the Civil War. And they came home, and people just didn't get it. They just, because the war wasn't here, they just didn't understand the phenomenal sacrifice. And we didn't know anything about PTSD. We didn't know anything about the long-term effects of...
At least we didn't know what to call it.
We didn't know anything. But people just went and got drunk.
Yeah, or people laughed at them and said, I don't know what's going on with them, but that's a sacrifice that lasts the entire life.
And then, for whatever it's worth, our government promised them a bonus. The recruiters promised them a bonus for fighting in World War I, and when the bonus wasn't paid, a whole bunch of them marched on Washington, D.C., and were confronted with gun barrels and with bullets in them and machine guns and told to go home, and they went home. But we didn't do things as well back then as we ought to. And it's a good time to remember that a lot of people made a great sacrifice. 68,400 Americans, not counting everybody else, died in Vietnam. And they didn't, whether or not strategically that was a success or a failure is beside the point. 68,400 Americans who could have fled to Canada.
At the behest of their nation, and that nation is us, went and did that.
Right, and the Korean War was, again, another one that was inconclusive, but all these people served, and it's a good time to remember them.
All right, and thank you. We are incredibly grateful, though I am a bit confused about something.
What?
Yesterday, a lot of people had the day off. Wasn't Veterans Day.
Well, only in the bond market, the stock market.
Well, a lot of schools had the day off. A lot of banks had the day off.
Because it was observed yesterday. Right. We saw it coming.
I don't know how you can observe tomorrow.
You can. You just look at the moon.
Well, in this case, it happened. They started observing tomorrow way before the moon was in tomorrow. It's a very interesting concept there.
We're
observing tomorrow. How? Can see the other side of the planet.
We can see the future. Well, you know, it's
all day yesterday. We could see the future. We were observing it.
Tomorrow was going to be Veterans Day. So
officially observed the future yesterday.
Except you. Unless you're in the stock market.
And then we just were stuck in the present.
Right.
Yeah. We're about out of time for this hour. We'll be back next hour, and we have not forgotten about the Venezuelan restructuring of debt.
Nor have we forgotten about
sanctions.
The two tax proposals that everybody is probably most interested in hearing about.
All right. Those are both important pieces of information that are being obfuscated rapidly by most major media outlets.
And the effect on the stock market of the fact that the going betting rate now is 50-50 on whether we'll get any kind of tax.
Right. So if you would like to contact us off the air, if you want to talk to us about the other side of what we do, which is giving personal advice in a fiduciary level to people with high net worths, our phone number to call, which is voicemail right now locally,
the area code 254, of course, is 947-1111.
You can reach that same voicemail and real life people during the week at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. You can read our philosophy, our newsletter, listen to podcasts of this program and many others going back into time. You can email us directly at jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. Until next hour, this has been The Personal Wealth Coach.
Radio 1400 KTM AM, Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood.